Welcome to the Minnesota Speculative Fiction Writers Group Podcast. Today's episode is Traditional versus Self-Publishing Deathmatch. Traditional publishing versus self-publishing. Who will win? Join the MinSpec Writers Group in a roundtable discussion as they analyze all your publishing options.
So, well, let's get started, I think, with the intros. If you've never been here before, this is MinSpec, the Minnesota Speculative Fiction Writers Meetup. And you are here for the traditional publishing versus self-publishing. What was it?
Deathmatch.
Which I think we're all too mellow to really fight to the death. But well, hopefully we can get a good debate going. We're going to go around and do our introductions. I'll start. I'm Hillary Moon Murphy. I am the disorganizer of this group of 350 souls. I welcome everybody to come to MinSpec meetings.
I'm Tim Rushford. I've been in the group for a little over a year, and I am in charge of the critique group that happens after this session.
I'm Conrad Zero. I have two short stories published traditionally and one novel coming up that should be done this year, and this is really interesting to me. Actually, the topic was my idea, because I'd like to decide by the end of the year whether I'm going to approach traditional publishers or publish myself.
I'm Dan Goodman, founder of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Masochists. Give them till it hurts.
I'm Rosalind. I've been coming to the Retrofits critique group. You're a hard act to follow. Been coming to the Retrofits critique group for a couple of years. I've been writing for a really long time and really never getting anything into publishable format. So I'm here just sort of to encourage myself to do that, think about the options once I get to that point.
I'm Michelle Gopeski. I've been a member for a couple of years. Just not been able to come. I've been writing for a long time, and encouraged me to have some friends. I am pressed to take my first short story that I finished and expanding into a novel. And I figure probably, I'm sitting today in the critique group for the first time. Next month I'm probably going to be old enough to submit my short story for critique.
Yay!
On it. It's, yeah, I'm kind of like, okay, I can do this. I'm kind of getting to that point where I can. Because I like hearing people's opinions and what people have to say, and just taking it and just going with it and working with it. And I'm in some other short stories here and there, but I'm focusing on my when I'm spanning to a novel.
So your first name again?
Michelle.
Okay. Well, I'm really glad you made it in. Welcome. And you shouldn't be afraid of the critique group here.
They're pretty laid back.
They're pretty laid back. There's a pretty good group.
Yeah, that's what I've been told. And I just want to observe and see what. Does it, I mean, I've had Dana and Michael both critique my short story, and I want just to kind of see what goes on in the critique group here, and then eventually get more involved in it.
Mm-hmm. I'm Joel Arnold, and I write a lot of fiction. I've had a number of stuff published traditionally, and I've self-published. I'm kind of on both sides of the debate.
And I'm Rachel Ford. This is the second time I've been here, actually. I think the last time I was here was back in April, maybe. I know it was after the big thing they had down in Bloomington, because I was right next to your guys' table. And I've got two books that are self-published in the same series, and I think I've made a total of about maybe $30 in a year from self-publishing, so but at the same time that doesn't really bother me a whole lot, and it's just really satisfying having my work out there and having it available.
Yeah. I'm Terry Faust. I've got some
short stories published and one novel, and I'm working on a whole pile of novels right now. And so the debate, I'm kind of in Conrad's situation. I'm debating whether to e-publish or look for an agent and go through the traditional publishing route.
I think maybe what we should do is talk a little bit about the traditional publishing route, too. I mean, maybe this is a good starter. It would have been nice if we had Michael or somebody who's got a novel. With your anthology that you did printed, well, did that involve any agents or anything along those lines?
No, at all? That was through Sam's Dot.
That was through Sam's
Dot. Yeah.
Okay.
What Oxcart Angel is through Sam's Dot?
No, I have an anthology called Bedtime Stories for the Apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
That's through Sam's Dot. That was through Sam's Dot. Yeah.
So I was just curious because I knew you had a printed anthology. So.
Somebody came in during the introduction.
Oh, come in.
I haven't actually said to my hand either.
Okay.
I'm Monica Wenzel. I'm at the pre-published stage, and I'm furiously outlining a novel, which I intend to write as soon as my current project is done, which is writing some short stories that somehow could take place in Minnesota and be specific to the month. So at the end, it'll be an anthology with some different stories relating to Minnesota and somehow the setting.
That sounds like fun.
I'm Andre Girard. I write as Tyler Torque. I've had some short stories published and some radio scripts and have completed two novels and have sent them around to agents without any luck so far. And so it's an interesting topic for me.
Yeah. Well, since you've actually sent things out to agents and stuff,
mm-hmm.
Describe your process.
Well, most agents want just a query letter. And so what I do is I try and find suitable ones. And so I look for books that are sort of like the kind of books that I write, and I research to find out who sold them to the publisher, which you can usually do. Or else I look for writers I like and see if it says on their website who their agent is,
mm-hmm.
and go with that. And so that's a good way, I think, of finding. And sometimes, you know, if I know them, I'll write to them and ask, what do you think of so-and-so who you're working with or who you worked with in the past? And sometimes they like it and sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to do some research up front to see if the agent would be a good fit for what I do and is good at their job. And then you want to carefully read the instructions on their website, if they have any. And if they don't, then there's a sort of a standard kind of query letter that you want to write, not too long, that describes the work briefly and something about yourself and only the relevant stuff. And then you wait and hear back whether they want to read more. Agents generally understand that there's a lot of long turnaround in publishing business and it doesn't take much effort to read a query letter. So simultaneous submissions are the norm when you're writing to agents.
Do you ever schmooze agents at conventions or anything?
Yeah, sometimes.
Like that? Yeah.
It's good to network and kind of get a feel for whether there's someone you think you could work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes you can actually even approach editors and ask for their card, but very few houses these days are accepting manuscripts directly. There are a few still.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be that the old route was you found your publisher after you submitted your whole novel, and the editor would look at it directly and go, yay, I want to publish you, and then you go and find an agent so that you can work out the contract. And now it seems like agents have become the slush piles for publishing houses.
Right.
Agents are the slush piles for
publishing houses.
Right.
A lot of publishing houses will not look at unagented manuscripts. There's a few left. I think Tor still does.
Sure.
Dar does, I think.
But yeah, so
does
sure, in November, we'll take an agented submissions. But then, you know, once she accepts it, she wants you to find an agent right away because she doesn't want to negotiate.
Oh, so even if they're accepting you without an agent, you get one involved once before the phone is
over. It probably depends on the publisher, too.
Yeah, my friend, Kacharani, who's a local author. She was one of those disgusting people who sold her first manuscript to the first place that she sent it for. And she immediately got basically told by them, look, go get an agent so that way, you know, there's not going to be any pain or questions over the negotiation process. And that's how she wound up with the agent she had, because she said, hey, I've sold this book, and, you know.
It's a lot easier to get an agent if you already have an offer.
Right, and, you know, but that was several years ago, and it's becoming less and less common. I'm hearing more and more people breaking in with the agent as opposed to breaking in without the agent.
I think part of that is the economy. Publishers don't like to hire people to look at manuscripts
even though you really don't have to pay them very much.
Well, yeah, well, a lot of slush readers aren't paid anything, so, but for some odd reason, the publishers love to have the agents now, or they realize they can get the agents to weed out the manuscripts that are, you know, unreadable or not acceptable, and save them a lot of time, so.
I think it's just a filter on the volume of submissions that are out there, at least it's a filter of sorts.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not going through the slush pile after an agent submits it. Is it going through another filter of slush pile?
It then goes to
agent admitter.
Then it goes to the editors, and the editors look it over and say, yeah, no. But it's a much smaller pile for an editor to go through, especially since if it's an agent you've worked with whom you know will send you stuff that's readable. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's a big question: is it readable?
Mm-hmm. I think too that a lot of times people would prefer not to be in the position of directly rejecting the author, because some authors don't take it very well.
What?
And they'll argue with you.
Like when Mike Merriam was, did his thing about how I'm an editor and how I select things, and there were like 8 people who had been rejected for Northern Lights at the table.
Yeah, you should explain what Northern Lights is for those folks.
Oh, Northern Lights and, come on. Sky Tinted Waters are 2 anthologies. I don't know why Sky Tinted Waters blew up my mind, because I've been reading it. I should be able to remember that title. But there are 2 anthologies that came out of this group, and Mike Merriam is our editor. And he did do a selection process for it. It was a much smaller slush pile for him, since it's a group of only 350 people, and I think only a small percentage of those actually submit. So, it was just very funny to watch Mike surrounded by people who would reject my anthology, waiting to hear. Explaining his process. So.
What's the best way for an unpublished author who's got a manuscript, fiction, to break into publishing and to getting an agent?
I think that there are multiple ways. I mean, if you look at people's stories of how they got published, especially how they got published in recent years, you'll find about 8 different types of stories. And a lot of them are the standard nose to the grindstone. I did the research, what Andre was talking about. I did the research, I found agents, I queried them.
Mind you, I haven't found an agent yet, so.
Yeah, but it's a very tough thing, and you have to try and sell your fantasy novel off of a query letter. And sometimes, you know, they don't want to see the manuscript. How many people want to see the manuscript?
I think I got, like, maybe 3 or 4 requests for partials and 2 or 3 full.
So your query letter actually did do its job. But, I mean, it can be tough because, I mean, I know Pamela Dean says that she just hates it because sending out query letters, I mean, this is somebody who's very published, because she said she much prefers sending the whole manuscript, because she said when they read my writing style, they get sucked in, but when, you know, to the story, but when they're looking at a query letter, she's not sure, she's not a good writer of query letters. And that's what she clearly feels, is that that's not her skill set. Her skill set is writing
novels.
So it's a very different skill set, and that can be...
See, I don't think that writing a query letter is that different a skill from writing a story. I think that,
that you want to
capture that same voice so that so that the person who reads the query knows what they're getting into. If it sounds like a business letter, even though it is a business letter, technically, if it sounds too much like a business letter, then you're going to lead them to expect that your work is dry.
Right. But I think it is a skill set to write in small and to write clever and enticingly in
it's
small.
It's true that she does do length better.
She does do length better. And so, you know, it's a very interesting thing to me how that works. Then there are things like Brian Keene's method of getting in, which I thought was just wonderful. He is a best-selling writer of horror. Currently, and he got broke in with, I think, a zombie book. I'm trying to remember. Do you remember the title of it?
The Rising.
The Rising. He broke in with a zombie book, The Rising, and his story of how he got in was just terrific. And that was that there was a pitch session at one of those conventions where a bunch of basically editors and agents and stuff are sitting around and they get pitched at all morning long. You get 3 minutes to do your pitch about your book. He went to the pitch session and he brought a cup of coffee and a sandwich. And he sat down next to the editor and dropped the cup of coffee and the sandwich. He says, "I know you've been going all day listening to people." He said, "I'm not going to even pitch to you. I just want you to have your break. I'm going to be in the bar afterwards." And he left his card. He said, "If you want to talk to me about my manuscript, I'd love it." He said, "I'll buy you a drink." And the editor came out afterwards and said, "Thank you for that cup of coffee. Thank you for that sandwich. They were terrific. Tell me about your book for a few minutes." And he was like, "It sounds fun. Why don't you send it to me?" Now he was lucky that the manuscript lived up to that thing, but he caught somebody who was in the middle of a bad day being pitched all throughout the day and stuff, and who was probably thirsty, hungry, etc. And he caught them at the right moment by being courteous, kind, and etc. And I just love that story because it shows us something different. I mean, but there's all sorts of different paths in. I mean, some people make things work that would never, ever work for anybody else. Like, for example, John Scalzi and his, you know, basically selling his manuscript by posting it to his blog. Now, it happens that his blog has more readers than most publishing, you know, most first runs of novels do on a daily hit basis. But basically, the editors of Tor were among his fans of his blog. They read the first few pages and then started reading the rest and then said, "Hey, do you want to publish this?" And, you know, that was a very weird thing. And so sometimes it's making a connection at the right time that can also affect it. But the nose to the grindstone method, I think, is the most common, and that's, you know, these days, which is the basically... But sometimes you can make connections at conventions and science fiction conventions. You can sort of say, "Hi, can I have your card?" With, you know, et cetera. I mean, there are times when you can do it in a nice fashion and stuff. And
being prepared for that moment is important, too.
Yeah, and you don't want to hand a manuscript...
I see that at all the conventions, and you hear it over and over, never to do that, but yet I see it. I saw it at 4th Street, somebody did that. And I'm like, really? People still do that?
Put yourself in their place.
Yeah.
You're going to be hauling that stuff back.
Right.
Yeah, so, but yeah, now let's talk about the pluses of traditional publishing. Once you get in, the pluses are pretty good. Yes, you still have to do a lot of your own marketing. Because as a first-time author, unless there's something that they consider to be a hot property, you know, you're that young prodigy who's a very sexy Harvard girl or whatever it is, and they think that you're going to be the next, you know, whatever it is, and they decide to put some money behind you. Or
you're spooky.
Or whatever it is. You know, they look at you and they see something that's... a marketing dream. Then they might market you, but most of the time you wind up marketing yourself. So that's a downside. But there's the distribution thing. I mean, a lot more copies of your thing are out, you're more likely to get reviewed in the traditional presses. I think that Kirkus reviews will basically review just about anything out of traditional press. Self-published stuff, I think you have to pay them a $750 reviewing fee, which doesn't, you know, guarantee you a oh, hi, Eric.
Any seats not taken?
Yeah, there are.
Pull up chair.
We were wondering if you wanted to talk with us about traditional publishing.
Yeah, it's cool. I need a bit of catching up.
That's fine. We were just talking about the process of publishing a novel traditionally, and then what happens after it comes out in the traditional press. So you've got a lot of volume behind you. You've got more chance for reviews. You've got more chance for attention.
Yeah.
I think those are the big things. It's like my personal opinion is, if you can make it work, and if the publishing houses will take you, I think it's worth it to go traditional. I really do. But the fact is that publishing has gotten a lot more finicky, and they don't always know everything. And so, as is evidenced by the few people who break out every year as self-published, you know, gods or goddesses. Go ahead.
Self-publication used to be considered shameful. I think the internet has disposed of that. What is a website with self-publication? There's lots of books and stuff out there. I still think, yeah, if you can get a major publisher to publish your work and pay you for it, you should try that first. Seriously, try a bunch of places first. But
I mean, even a small publisher is fine if they've got the distribution channels.
Yes.
I would say there are levels of publishers. You start at vanity presses where you pay them for 1,000 books, and basically they're a printing company. They may charge you for like editing services and proofing and so on. And
they rarely accept manuscripts.
Exactly. In fact, a lot of them are styling themselves as publishers. And for authors, I've talked to a couple of authors who say, oh, yeah, this, you know, very fancy publisher is publishing my book, and you know, it only cost me $5,000 or $2,000. I said, well, they're a vanity press. They're going to publish your book, you know, if it was like pages of the phone book or something. So there's levels above the vanity press. There's print-on-demand publishers. They don't charge you. They will take your book and print it up, but they will also not support you in any way, shape, or form. And oftentimes what they're doing is they're hoping you have lots of friends and you are good at marketing and you will sell that book for them so they'll get their profit back. And then you've got levels up to, what is it, they call them the Magic Six or Three or something like that, the big publishers.
The Big Six.
The Big Six, that's what it is. So you really, if you're a first-time novelist, you're generally overjoyed if you get a print-on-demand publisher or above, because you're not paying them. But also, depending on who it is, you may find yourself with someone who's published your book and it just sits there. And you didn't realize that it's up to you totally to market the thing, to get the word out about it, to send it to reviewers, because they don't do it. And in fact, they may not even proof or edit your book. If you send something to them that's full of typos and grammar problems, they'll just print it that way. So you have to be kind of careful.
If you're pursuing that route, it's a real good idea to have at least one friend to proof it for you.
Yes.
And I know traditional publishers also, they have a whole department that, the big ones have a whole department that'll market this to libraries, for example, which small presses don't necessarily do. And obviously, they self-publish.
Yeah, print-on-demand doesn't even go into libraries, and it oftentimes, even though you're being sold through Barnes & Noble and Amazon online, Barnes & Noble won't actually carry your book on their shelves.
How do you want to market your book?
Google. Google marketing. Try everything and keep track of what works. That's about all I can tell you.
Yeah, I mean, I think marketing could be a whole other panel all to itself. I've seen all kinds of things.
The Writer's Handbook is still handy, right? Which is available in public libraries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I don't know if it carries as much of the marketing end of it as...
There is a book like that. I think it's called A Thousand Ways to Market Your Book. Or maybe it's 110. It's probably more like 1,000. Barry Levinson is a guerrilla marketing expert, and he's a good one to check online. His name is Levinson. I think it's Gary Levinson. No, Barry Levinson.
I can tell you one way not to market your book. Don't market your book by going onto everybody else's site and just posting. Read my book and posting the blurb and not responding to anybody's comments. We banned somebody for that. I mean, we have a self-promotion, a shameless self-promotion on our board, and we open that up as the safety valve, because all writers want to talk about their books, and we want to hear about what you guys do. But if you're posting in every single thread and you're not paying any attention to what it's about, and you're just saying, buy my book, buy my book, buy my book, but people come up with the conclusion is that you are an asshole and a jerk and that you can't read.
Do market your book by going to science fiction conventions and having interesting things to say on a wide range of topics. Don't market your book by going to science fiction conventions and talking about nothing but your book.
No. I think that's a very key thing. I think that's the reason why some blogs are very useful marketing tools. And the blogs that are useful marketing tools aren't the ones that talk endlessly about why you should buy my book, but the ones that people go into on a regular weekly basis or daily basis to read because they're just fun and entertaining. They like the author's style. And those tend to be more successful because then if they like your blog and they get entertained by it. The few times that you do mention, oh, by the way, I sold this story or I published this book, you can get a boost from... people going, oh, I think I will pick this up.
One of the downsides that I've been hearing about traditional publishing, especially from Christine Catherine Rush's blog, is that Christine, at least, feels that the publishing industry has gone through a lot of changes, and no one's really sure where it's going to end up, and the publishers are running scared, and the agents are running scared, and as a result, They're issuing contracts to authors that try to grab as many rights as they can forever.
Yes.
And that if you want to go traditional publishing, you really, really have to get someone who knows contracts to review whatever is sent to you before you agree to it. And some of them have even been trying to revise agreements after publication and saying, here's the new terms. Unilaterally, and so this is something where she's recommending you don't want an agent, because the agents are working on the side of the editors. Basically, you want someone who's going to be on your side, that you pay by the hour, an IP lawyer who has relevant experience in that area to negotiate the contract for you. You don't need to pay someone else 15% for this. Pay them for 6 hours by the hour or whatever it is. I'm wondering how people feel about that.
Well, an IP lawyer saved Jason from selling all rights to Tile Chess. Because when my very first effort of selling something, it was actually not something of my own, it was Jason Whitman's game, Tile Chess. And that was a number of years ago. And he gave me a demo and played it, and I said, I think Steve Jackson would publish this. And I was going to a science fiction convention, and I saw Steve Jackson there. And I went up to his table, and I talked to him for quite a bit about how much I enjoy his various games and stuff. And then I asked him if I could have his card and stuff. And then I wrote him after the convention and said, Mr. Jackson, I was wondering if you'd be interested in a game thing. Feel free to tell me no, but we met at the convention, we talked about these things, I'm the person who, yada, yada, yada. And I got back I'm not really in the market for chess variants, but okay, I'm willing to take a look at it, no promises. So And it was a very interesting thing because we negotiated back and forth over these things. We made the best demo. We sent it in. And eventually we got a, well, I might be interested in publishing it. If you are interested in it, here's this contract. And I looked at this contract. I said, this looks really bad. I mean, it looked really bad to my eyes. So I wound up contacting a friend who knew an IP lawyer and said, can you find me? You know, can you connect me up with this person and stuff? And the IP lawyer said, I'll take a quick look at it. And she called me back instantly and said, don't sign that damn contract. And I said, how much do I need to pay you for that opinion? She says, well, let's start with don't sign that damn contract. And then we got into negotiation about the fees and stuff. And it was, I think we made back more than the money that, you know, in terms of what we would have lost in rights and stuff. And she made a bunch of suggestions that then we counter-proposed to Steve Jackson. And it was very funny because Steve's reaction was, oh, okay. Well, I thought it was worth a try. And then, and then we got a real contract that actually had decent terms.
Right. The people who are negotiating these contracts, or not negotiating, but issuing these contracts on behalf of publishers, don't see it as we're trying to screw over the author. They see it as we're trying to get the best deal we can.
Mm-hmm.
We have an obligation to our company. You know, it's a business. We're trying to make money. And so we want to, you know,
and
make as much money as we
start
can.
Start with their best.
Right.
And let's face it, Steve does most of his work as work for hire because big ideas are usually his, and then he's hiring out writers. In this case, the idea was somebody else's. And that was the argument we made, was that it was somebody else's concept. So.
I'm not surprised to hear that, but was it J.K. Rowling? They didn't have electronic rights in her original contract. And so now that the series is all finished, everything that she's doing online with her Pottermore set and all that is all going into her pocket. That's all the publishers out of it. So I can see publishers going, what could we be missing out on next that we don't see today? You know, so they try to cover all the bases just by saying,
well, you know, the publisher can make enough money by having the rights for a specific format for 7 years or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not unless you want to have them pay a bunch more money, they shouldn't have the rights in perpetuity. People's things should revert to them, and they can do their own backlists and published.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I think work for hire is a totally different thing. If you're working in somebody else's universe, and something that would never sell otherwise outside of that universe, they've already put in a tremendous amount of creative input, and they're hiring you and paying you accordingly, then work for hire is okay. But if it's your own original stuff, no, you don't want to do that.
I think we've kind of wandered into the sort of a fine area of the legal aspects of
contracts.
Let's go back
to self-publishing then.
Yeah.
All right, so I think what you've got here is you've got the question of traditional publishing with the big, you know, background and the, you know, monolith and the ability to market places and at least get your work seen and the distribution channels. And you've got self-publishing where you have 100% control over everything. And so you've got kind of two very different worlds. I think that if you're a marketing whiz, you probably are going to be fine self-publishing, but I would still try doing the traditional first, provided you've got somebody to, you know, look over the contracts. I think the other problem is that traditional publishing is so scared that they're not looking much outside the box anymore for different stuff. And I think that's been one of the big issues that I've been seeing, is that they're not taking as many risks. So they're looking for stuff that's just a little bit different from what they're selling now. So something that's really different may be having issues getting sold. Let's pass it around.
One of the things that came up that I had never really thought of before was that if you decide to self-publish, and maybe self-publishers here can say if this is true or not, but if you're going to say, okay, I'm self-publishing, you're giving up some of your writing time to do these things that the publisher would have done for you, like marketing, like submitting to contests or awards or stuff like that. So can anybody here speak to that? Anybody self-publishing who finds out that they spend, okay, I used to spend 10 hours a week writing, now I'm doing 5 hours a week and 5 hours of marketing or self-promotion or whatever.
Yeah.
Anybody have that?
Yeah. I think that's very true.
Is it?
Yeah.
Would you say it's half, or let's say I'm trying to decide between this and that, am I giving up half of my writing or a quarter? Or
It's up to you, but I mean, basically I have.
Yeah.
You're constantly thinking, I should be marketing my book instead of, you know, I'm going to go have some fun or something. No, I shouldn't have fun. I should be marketing my book.
I mean, it sounds like people who get a book with a traditional publisher are still putting a lot of effort into marketing
yes.
the book, too.
Yeah, I think even the big publishers, although I don't know that, my publisher is just a wee little publisher, and the marketing effort is almost entirely my own. I want the book to succeed. So.
Yeah, like a traditional publisher, even though you still do some of your own marketing, they do a lot of the stuff. They still do a lot of things that you would have to do on your own as a self-publisher. So,
I think I would love to know a little bit more, because you're doing both, the traditional and the self, in abundance. And I would love to hear about your experiences, Joel. And Joel has published a whole bunch of horror and a few other stories, some literary ones as well. But
he seems so nice.
I know, but for such a sweet guy, he does such mean, evil stories.
I've republished a lot of my short stories that were traditionally published as anthologies that I self-published, and I also have self-published some of my novels. And a few of those novels did have an agent at one point, but that kind of fell through, and I lost patience going that road, which... So I decided to self-publish them, and I think the best part about, or the negative part about self-publishing is that some people might want to try to publish too fast. It's very easy to just throw your work out there without going through all the time of polishing it and kind of honing your craft. I guess that's the biggest negative aspect I see.
Do you have other people edit your books?
My wife.
Is your wife a professional editor or just?
No, she's good. I mean, I edit my stuff a lot, and I know you need another set of eyes, but I write about probably 10, 12 drafts of everything. So, and then she goes through it with a red pen, and she likes to be. Ruthless, but I've also like my novels. I did have an agent for them, and she had a lot of input. And then also, even though they never ended up selling to a major publisher, yeah.
I used to be a clerk typist, and part of my job was to ask whether did you really mean to write the Soviet Union in the 19th century? And there are all the things that look right to the because you know what you meant.
Right. Yeah, that's very true.
And I think I've been doing research on editors that. They do nothing but take manuscripts and edit them. And they've got layers of services they'll provide, from basic typo correction to right up to base, you know, kind of becoming a ghostwriter for you, doing creative suggestions on where you want to go with even your basic story. So, but they'll delineate, and of course, you know, the one at the top where they're giving you all sorts of creative input, plus finally going to whatever you come up with as a manuscript, edit it and proof it and make sure it's pristine to send off, that's going to be up probably Well, it depends on how long your book is, but you can be looking at thousands of dollars.
Can the writer learn to self edit stuff and do a
I think the answer to that is yes, but not everybody has that skill set in abundance. And I mean, I find it very interesting that some people I know who are professional novelists also have as a sideline doing this kind of editing, book doctoring. Alma, what is her last name? She wrote The Tale of the Ginsei. I'm trying to remember. But I remember looking at her website, and she had a thing where she does writer retreat weekends where you pay $900 for her and her husband to go over your manuscript with them. And they apparently provide, you know, light meals for and you know, it was like a description of a bed and breakfast, except for you have a pair of professional writers go through this. And I came to the realization this is a significant supplement to their income.
Yeah,
and, you know, it may not be all that unreasonable if you're considering that they're putting you up in your house for their house for a weekend and going over your manuscript and doing, you know, a whole bunch of other things, and you know, it might actually be a worthwhile thing. Who knows? But I was just very amused because Alma Alexander. That's it. I was very amused to see this as her side business, you know, and you know. But hey, if she's making it work and if she's actually giving a good service, I don't have any problem with her, you know, doing that. So long as you know you're upfront and stuff. I don't think you have to pay anywhere near that kind of money, but it all depends on how good you are at catching your own stuff, and you know, I mean, you can hire somebody to copy edit, probably at a reasonable rate if you've got a reasonable manuscript to start. You know, that Ellie, I don't think, or Eli, sorry, Eli Effinger Bontrop, I know she charges for copy editing, but I don't think she charges a ton.
No, she's very reasonable. Michael Merriam does too.
If you've got any kind of problems with English usage, an adult education class is a real good idea.
How can you learn to do a real good job on self-editing?
See, here's the thing. I don't believe that, except for very rare cases, I don't believe that many people can do a good job on self-editing because it's coming from your head. You know what you intended to say, and someone else who's new to the material is duplicating the experience of a reader, and it's really, really hard for you to come to your own work with fresh eyes and see how someone else would see it.
But you can do trading off of manuscript critiquing.
I'll also add, if you're trying to do it yourself, two techniques that really help is put it away for a month and then come back to it, and read it aloud. When you're reading it aloud, you catch stuff that you wouldn't believe.
Hey, your mind fills in blanks. I mean, if you're writing really fast, you know, you might skip a the or an and or something, but when you go back and read it, your head still puts it back in there, and you don't see the missing word.
That danger is greatly increased with the development of word processors.
No, actually, I have to give my Kindle full credit for this. It is awesome. That machine voice is awesome at reading my manuscripts and making me go, you know, as it's going through it's going through, and you listen to that machine voice reading your manuscript as it's going, and you suddenly realize, I left out a whole bunch of words there. You know, that didn't make sense. And, you know, you stop it, and then you go, you know, go through, I mean, I just, you know, and you go back a page, and then you just turn it on again, and you go, okay, where was that? Oh, there it is.
Of course, there you're talking about line edits, and there are, of course, many different levels at which you can look at a manuscript. There's the whole, have I given enough information for someone to understand what's going on in the scene thing. There's the structural and the level of conflict throughout the story. There's, do people's motivations make sense? Are they consistent with what you've established about their character in the earlier chapters? And this is all stuff that I think it's easier generally for someone else to see.
It's a really good idea to, always has been a really good idea to do your piece and more than one medium, you know, whether you start out by handwriting it and then go to a word processor, or start with a word processor and then do something else.
Yeah, because that forces you to be careful.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's what I handwrite it out.
That's why you can, you know, you can lose paragraphs, pages in a word processor without noticing. It's
what Terry said about looking at it in a month. Whatever Stephen King's on writing, which was a long time ago, the only thing that I really took out of there long term was that he puts a manuscript in a drawer for 6 months. Mm. And then he goes back to it. Well, the other golden part about that is then you keep writing, you know. So you've got other things to take up the slack while you're waiting for that to percolate.
Yeah, don't let, I think Joel was saying, don't let this, you know, I've got to get it out there. I just got to send it in. If that, you know, if that really takes over, you're going to be submitting stuff that is not totally what you'd call readable. And what will happen is, even if you're sending it into a critique group, people will be picking on things that you could have fixed yourself if you just let it sit and gone back and looked at it. And what happens is you get a real kind of a down attitude about your writing. It's like, boy, how can I make all these mistakes? Well, you know, everybody does, but everybody but Andre.
I wonder if you learn to self-edit to a point that you can cut that on the course of Ohio.
Let's put it this way. The probably your best experience in learning how to self-edit is critiquing other people's stuff. Mm-hmm. If you critique other people's stuff, you start seeing the errors that are driving you nuts, and then you start noticing, oh, wait a minute, I did that! I mean, and it's much easier to see these mistakes in somebody else's work. It's probably the best way to learn how to edit yourself is to edit other people.
And because you're trading off of their critiquing your stuff, I mean, it's less effort, frankly, because, yeah, you could probably learn to go over all your own stuff and be totally self-sufficient, but it's hard work. To get that attitude and to just come at it and look at all the different things when you already know all this stuff about it.
You can teach yourself to use active verbs rather than passive verbs by going over your manuscript and circling every was and were. And if you've got like 50 on that page, that needs fixing.
That's another nice thing for word processors.
There's adverbs.
Adverbs.
Yeah. That, you know that book, I can't think of it right offhand. It's a little paperback book by
Struck Away.
The Elements of Style.
The Elements of Style. Would that be a real good way to learn to self edit your stuff?
No.
I think that that's a great guide to just grammar, and it's probably a good starting point for just active use of language. But that's all it is. It's only micro level. It doesn't deal with story. It doesn't deal with.
I think it's a great guide to grammar if you want to sound like an English professor. I don't think they're, you know, the grammar that people actually use and expect to find in a manuscript.
This is the sort of arid pedantry up with which I shall not play.
Exactly.
Winston Churchill.
It's good to know the rules so that you can break them, I think.
What was that?
It's good to know the rules so that you can break them or, you know what you're doing. Right. Yeah.
So, but I don't even agree with all their rules.
All right. So say you've given traditional publishing a try, and you've sent it out, and there are all the editors in the world are morons, and you know you decide, okay, I
don't
just
post it on your blog, by the way.
Yeah. I did post it. Especially, and then name them all.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Why are you so
right up there with talking about your boss?
That's been done.
Yes.
Yes. So they're all morons and idiots. You decide that you're going to go self-publish. What should you be aware of when you are self-publishing, other than the fact that you're going to be marketing the heck out of it, and you just pissed off every editor?
Yes, you're going to want a gas mask for the smoke of the bridges burning behind you.
Well, even though the stigma has greatly reduced in self-publishing, there's still going to be some people dubious about, okay, you published this yourself. If it was any good, why couldn't you get somebody else to do it?
Boy.
It's less of a problem than it was. But
yeah. I got one. Oh.
I want to say it really helps if you already have an audience.
Yes.
If you already have people who are following your blog or whatever, and you can say, hey, here's my new thing. Go buy it.
I find it really interesting to look at Jim Hines' blog, especially whenever he does his yearly analysis of where his writing income comes from. Which is a very, very interesting thing to look at the things, because he's been doing that now once a year for a few years now. And, you know, his percentage of the self-published things, which are his short story anthologies, has gone up a bit, but it is such a small portion of his income. And he's got a blog, you know, that gets about 4,000, 5,000 hits a day. He said more if he's doing one of his photo things, like fantasy book covers or whatever he did. He did one about women posing on fantasy book covers where he did all the poses.
That one
has, he says, over 500,000 individual unique hits at that point for just that blog entry alone, where he did all the poses.
Did he get any fashion modeling jobs out of that?
Well, when he did pose like a man, that was also very funny. But I liked that one too. That was almost as good. But you know, he's got a pretty heavy duty readership on his you know, 3 or 4 times a week blog, and you know, he was talking about how he makes somewhere around $40 a month off of his self publishing. You know, that's not a huge percentage of his income, because he's, you know, now at the point where, you know, he's making somewhere around $50,000 a year from his writing. And so enough that he could quit were health insurance not an issue. And because he's diabetic, he's keeping his full-time job as a computer programmer, because health insurance is definitely an issue, and because he's not sure that the writing gravy train is going to last. You know, it's like, okay, it was $50,000 this year. It's big, and part of the reason for when it got big was, okay, his first jump in writing income, and he had it over year by year analysis. His first jump was getting accepted by Dawn, big major publisher. First time, so it's like all of a sudden, you know, he started to get reasonable things. Then every time a new book has come out and they've been series, that ups, all the other books sell, and that ups his income a bit more. Apparently, Germany is nuts for goblins. And his goblin stories have sold very, very well in Germany. So with all of the foreign rights that his publisher has been selling in Germany, and this is a major publisher, he's now actually making a really decent living every year off of his writing. But, you know, he was talking about, you know, his self-publishing and even his goblin tales, which are based off of his really good-selling goblin books. You know, I mean, he's getting $40-$50 a month off of the sales of goblin tales. You know, that's not a huge amount. It's nice. It's better than I think I could do, and that's somebody who has a format off of which he's selling his, you know, a place to sell his stuff, because he's got a very, very well-read blog.
It's worth noting that if you're in it for the money, you really shouldn't be writing fiction. Nonfiction is so much easier to sell. And you know, you're talking about him making $50,000 a year on this. I could easily make $50,000 a year writing technical articles in my profession, because those go for $5,000 a pop. And they're easy to sell. You know, the editors write to me and say, do us another article. So it's not, you know, nonfiction that you do for love, basically.
Yeah, the reason I write fiction is not to make money. The reason for making money is to give you the time to write fiction.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like that running a bookstore thing.
Yeah, sort of don't give up your day job. Yeah, do it.
On self-editing, something which might be worth and be a topic on itself is, for God's sakes, if you're going to write other people's dialect or other people's professional jargon or other people's political jargon, for God's sakes, get a native speaker to look it over. And for dialect, there are jobs. There may be literal sounds that you literally don't hear in the other, like, And for one thing...
Unless you've got a perfect pitch here like Mark Twain did.
Like what?
But he had a lot of experience. Yeah.
A perfect pitch here like pitch. Mark Twain.
We don't know. He might have gotten, you know, we don't
that's
know
true.
What he ran.
Yeah.
I think that the fact that, you know, there are people who do. I mean, Diana Gabaldon faked the whole Scottish thing so well that she got the best Scottish new writer, and she had to write them back and say, I'm not Scottish.
Yeah, but
I mean, it was, you know, I mean, they thought she was a Scot. So, you know, this Scot, you know, this is so, you know, I mean, so, I mean, there are people who have that ear.
In our field, Theodore Sturgeon.
Yes, but there are people who have that ear, but there are other people like, John Brunner, and John Brunner who doesn't, or like, there are Canadian writers who don't realize that Americans, that the U.S. doesn't have girl guides, it has girl scouts.
Yeah. Back to self-publishing versus traditional. I was talking with somebody who's just recently broke out as a picture book writer for Little Brown. And so different than what most of us are doing, but I was kind of curious because I know her because she's a patron at my library, and she once, you know, did a story time with me of some of her self-published picture books. You know, which she sold little bits and pieces of it. I mean, she's never really made any kind of living off of it. She basically breaks even, I think, with her publications and stuff. And she does Tai Chi, and apparently she was at a big Tai Chi conference, and she was next to somebody else named Ed Young, who was doing Tai Chi. And he asked her what she liked to do, and she said, well, I like to write picture books. And he goes, anything I heard? But she said, no, I just self-publish stuff. She said, I'm working on a story about ninjas. He said, I love ninjas. Can you send it to me? She didn't know that Ed Young was a Caldecott winning illustrator. And he liked her story, and he said, said to Little Brown, hey, I've got this new person who's got this great ninja story, and I want to illustrate it. So she's suddenly now in the world of everybody, you know, I mean, she went through panic attacks because they changed her prose, they wanted to have a splash page with no words on it, you know, et cetera. And I had to spend some time calming her down and showing her other professional picture books and going, look at this. I said, the fact that they cut down your word count, you know, is actually not a bad thing because in story time, I look for things that are one or two sentences a page. And she was like, okay. And, you know, it was slows her keeping the mood and stuff. But it was very interesting watching the levels of panic as Little Brown, you know, monolith, you know, took on her manuscript. But they made it really good. And it was really good to begin with, but they made it even better. They cut it down, I think, by 25% and, you know, made it tight. Very tight, because it's a picture book manuscript. And, you know, now they're doing things like, you know, she's doing a ninja day with us because she wanted to, and this was planned before, you know, we heard that Little Brown has its own marketing thing and stuff. And they, you know, they heard about this and they're like, well, can we send our, you know, marketing gear? We've got giveaways, we've got bookmarks, we've got, and it's like, very interesting, totally different, you know, where you've got, obviously, they're putting some marketing effort behind this because I think they're looking at this as a next potential. Ed Young's won the Caldecott before. They're looking at it as maybe we can get another Caldecott. And they're putting some marketing effort behind it, which is, and, you know, they told her, and here's your book tour. And so it's, you know, this does happen still for people. And now it helped that she is partnering with somebody who is really well-known and that he really liked her story and he, you know, did that. But that's something that you can't get from a self-publisher. And so, you know, if there's the opportunity, I mean, sometimes if they decide that they want to push your thing, they put a lot of marketing grease behind it. And so
I've heard of other people talk about this as a business model for getting into traditional publishing by proving yourself through self-publishing. Amanda Hawken did it. I mean, that's an extreme case, but if you release something and show that there's some interest in your work on your own, then you can go to a publisher, maybe with book two or another book, and say, look, I've got
email list, I've got fan base, I've got website hits, I've got book two.
I don't know if I have the marketing cojones to do what, I mean,
I don't know what people think of that, Terry.
Yeah. Amanda Hocking was like hell to...
Amanda Hocking put
how many
so
books
much.
Did she have before? She
had tons.
She had a lot of stuff.
Cranking them out every couple
there's
of months.
Most of the
yeah, she's been cranking them out every 2 months. They are very entertaining. I have to admit, her first zombie novel all has problems. I mean, you can tell that this is something that was no professional editor way near. With all its problems, though, it was incredibly funny, the enthusiasm she went with each time she offed a zombie. It was in a totally different manner. And she got so into the technicolor offing of zombies and stuff. Her books were a blast. I mean, they were just fun to read. So I could see why somebody would go, oh, that was just a fun ride. I'll buy the next one. I mean, honestly, I didn't go off and buy the next one because zombies aren't my thing. But I thought about it, which is saying something considering that zombies are totally not my thing. But she works like hell. I mean, she was on a whole bunch of blogs that and forums on, you know, zombies and that kind of thing. She had active Twitter feed. She participates in all kinds of discussions. She's everywhere online if you know, looking around. That is a person who is putting a lot of marketing time into the stuff.
Yeah,
just a ton.
Who's this?
Amanda Hocking, a local Minnesota writer.
Very famous.
She was on a message board that I frequent, and I remember... She'd talk about her sales, Kindle boards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I remember her saying, like, I, like in this last week I sold 10,000 copies of, and this was before she got a major deal. So, yeah, it was kind of fun to watch her in New York in her eyes.
Yeah.
I've heard the other way, too, that if you self-publish and there is no audience or you don't sell well, Michael Merriam was saying this, that your numbers can follow you through your book scan, is it, I think? So when you approach a publisher later with book two, they look back and go, oh, you know, you didn't sell well on book one, so we don't want you for future book. I have no family.
I think the long and short of it, whether you're going print or e-publishing, is unless you're willing to market your book and spend a lot of time at it, you can write books, and you can put them like on Smashwords or KDP for free and get people to read them. But you're probably not going to make money on it unless you market yourself with a vengeance. Did J.K.
Come, Andrew, don't say it. This isn't the Girl Scout meeting, right? This is not a Girl Scout
meeting. We're the Girl Guides. Did J.K. Rowling and Suzanne Collins market their work?
You could argue that Suzanne Collins did some marketing. I mean, she certainly wasn't... Hunger Games was not her first book. She had quite a success with the Gregor the Underlander series that she did for younger readers. And that was going, you know, and she, you know, would participate in things and stuff like that. But I think that in the young adult and children's area, there's still a lot of marketing that happens by publishers, and there's a lot of things that are done by sales via libraries, where I think still 70% of hardcover youth sales are to libraries from the big six publishers. She got a big six publishing contract. She did well. And then she did Hunger Games. And Hunger Games came out of nowhere. It was one of those things where, yeah, she had a good, you know, I mean, Gregor the Underlander was definitely a good selling series. But that was word of mouth, I think, that carried the Hunger Games through. And Hunger Games created a wave of dystopic stuff that all of a sudden anybody who had a dystopic manuscript suddenly got picked up. It was just really interesting to watch the post-Hunger Games wave go through the publishing world. But with Hunger Games, I mean, I remember it was just a hardcover like any other that came into our library, and I wasn't going to touch it because it was about a battle to the death. Until a couple of my teens came up to me and said, "You must read this." And, you know, when School Library Journal had their Battle of the Books, I can't remember, was it 2008 or something? pair of teenage girls did this whole song, 16, 16, you know, which they were based off of the high school musical song, 16, where they kept talking about the one book that must win them all, win the battle. And they kept bringing up Hunger Games and, you know, singing lines about Katniss. And that YouTube video was one of those big flash-in-the-pan things that a whole bunch of people watched because it was two very cute high school girls who sang a lot and who were tossing books merrily around a room and singing songs about Katniss Everdeen. There was this huge wave of readership where kids were blogging to each other on YouTube about it. And, you know, I mean, so it had this huge word-of-mouth thing that happened, and then it started to build, and by the time the second book came out, the publisher was suddenly putting the big guns behind it. And so, I mean, I just noticed that wave of where the publisher came in on the second book. But that one was a kind of surprise. And I think it was a surprise in the same way that the J.K. Rowling books were a surprise. The first one was okay. I mean, you know, it sold okay. By the time the second one, it was starting to build readership. I think both of those were examples of word of mouth. And I don't think you can predict those as much as publishers would like to.
When you say word of mouth, how does that develop? And what do you mean by that?
I mean kids telling other kids, this is an awesome book, you have to read it.
I think Harry Potter is a great example of that, because that really blew up before there was ever really any big, huge internet thing going on.
Right. Harry Potter blew up. About book three was when the buzz started really building on Harry Potter. And there, all the Harry Potter fan sites started to come up, and other things happened, and things like that. I mean, with Hunger Games, I literally had two of my read team volunteers drag me against a wall and say, you must read this book. And I was like, I don't want to read it. It's about kids battling to the... You're going to read this book. Okay, fine. So I said, I'll read the first three chapters, and if I don't like it... And they said, ha-ha. And they laughed at me. They laughed at me because, you know, I was immediately a convert, and then I was telling everybody, you have to read this. I mean, it was one of those things where it was an excellent book, and it was the best thing I'd read in 2008, and I told people it was the best thing I'd read in 2008. But I saw that wave come in of word of mouth, and I saw all these kids blogging about, you know, there are kids who do book reviews on YouTube, where they will review a book on YouTube, and they'll do the review of why they like this book, and other kids will do video things back for it. I mean, it's really kind of wild to watch the teen video reviewing market, and it made the circuit. So there were teens just basically telling other teens about it, and that's not something publishers can really buy. I mean, they can try and do wonderful book trailers and stuff on YouTube, and they can do all kinds of fancy marketing, but the marketing power came in on the second book. That's when I saw them suddenly actually really marketing this thing and buying the big ads in Library Journal and everything. But Hunger Games came in just as any other book. It didn't have any marketing behind it other than just what you see in a normal TV novel.
Which, you know, and I think that that's going to accelerate. I think there are going to be more venues for that sort of thing and for non-traditional ways of finding things to read. And that's great, because that means the quality can win out.
That quality, even if you,
quality can win out.
Provided it gets the initial attention burst that it needs. I mean, there are times when you read a fabulous book and you go, why didn't anybody else read it or like it?
But, you know,
that's a good segue into e-publishing, though.
Yeah.
E-publishing is like blanket bombing, whereas print publishing is more like strategic bombing, if that makes any sense. E-publishing, you've got people every day throwing their novels for free out there and just thrilled that people will download them for free and read them. And they're not making a cent on it. And yet, you know, they'll say things like, well, geez, now I've got to get another novel out there. And, you know, I'm thinking, well, you made nothing on the last one. Maybe you'll make twice as much on the next one. I have to wonder about the logic going on there.
But I do think that there's, if you're writing a series and you're okay with not pulling income on the first ones, but maybe later, as people like future books, they would go backwards.
Well, that's the theory. And
I don't know if that's the true theory, but it is.
Following Smashwords on that to see if that works. If you've got a big base of people that like the free book, and then you either you put it out for 2 days for downloads free. In fact, there's even sites now where you can broadcast that in a couple of days or a week, you're going to post your book on Smashwords or KDP or what have you for free for 2 days, and after that it's going to be $5 or $2 or something. And the people that read these things will rush in there, read the thing, and if it's worthwhile, the theory is that word of mouth will carry over and people will continue to want it and buy it.
And I've heard that is pretty effective, actually.
It certainly is for Hunger Games. I mean, Hunger Games has gone, and not only for free, but for dirt cheap. I mean, Amazon has sold it for $1 a couple times in ebook format. And it's been really interesting how it's done that a couple times, and every time they do that, then they wind up selling the other two for full price. Mm-hmm. Like pretty much in the week, because
actually,
people finish Hunger Games and they're like, have the next one.
The truth is, Hunger Games isn't a book; it is a third of a book. Yeah. Those three books are not a trilogy. That is a book split into three parts, which is kind of not fair. And that's exactly why that business model works. If you give them
Lord of the Rings,
Lord of the Rings, another example. Yeah, you can't just read Fellowship.
So if you have
books are that way,
yeah.
She said when she wrote them, she had a manuscript this tall and realized it was 5 books.
Yeah. And I call that the drug dealer business model. They get for free and then they'll be back for the...
Don't mess with what works.
Then they're putting out a few chapters for free and...
Right.
Yes.
And I...
They let you read a chapter or so, and peeks in the book.
And e-books lends itself to that so perfectly. That if that's really what's working, I think that's going to bury print publishing.
And that's dependent on quality. If you release the free thing and it's okay,
that's where I was saying. There's for every Hunger Games or any other book, quality ebook that's published, there is just a
boatload of direct.
Yeah, just a vast collection of really awful stuff. So. How the reviewing takes place on that and how word of mouth hits on the good one is something that's being worked out.
Seems like we need some automation there. To filter out some of the worst of the worst.
Right.
Yeah, that would be like 50%.
More than that.
90.
When
you say quality, what does that mean?
That's such an elusive thing. I think, for me, quality is, does it tell a really good story? Can the person tell a story? And, with Amanda Hawking, she badly needed an editor in her zombie stuff. But she could tell a damn good kick-ass story, and her characters were fun, and her descriptions were fun, and there was a ton of enthusiasm that carried the book. She could tell a story. A lot of people would say it wasn't well written because there were a ton of grammar issues and things like that popped up throughout the thing. But the fact is that I was willing to ignore it because she told such a good story. And I think a lot of people don't know how to do that.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of elusive. I think the industry calls it traction or legs. If something, they talk about throwing things against the wall. They'll take a series of books and throw them up against the wall. They'll release them in the same way. And whichever one wins or comes out ahead in sales, they'll put more marketing push behind that one because it has the potential to go to where these books, these other ones can't. And it's kind of if they could put their finger on it, they wouldn't have bothered throwing these other books in the wall.
I think that makes an awful lot of sense, though. I mean, it really does.
Yeah.
If you've already pulled forward a certain amount on your own, it makes sense that with a little bit more exposure, you could actually go places.
It's the same thing with the music.
You've been very quiet, and you've been effectively self-publishing a series of anthologies that you do that, you know, you're sending, and they're not necessarily your own stories, but other people's stories for a very long time. It's like garnered some awards and stuff. Do you want to talk about Tales of the Unanticipated and your self-publishing journey? I mean, because you started that, didn't you, years ago? 15, 20 years ago?
26.
26 years ago.
He looks so young, too. The Minnesota Science Fiction Society was had a vacancy for an editorial team for a fan magazine, Fancy. And Dan and I went in together and came up with a bit, which they thought was all well and good, but not a fancy. They were willing to entertain the proposal for a semi-prosing, so I came back to them with a different title, which they I was offering, which I wanted to hang on to, and they said that if they were going to publish something, they wanted the title, so I came up with Tales of the Unanticipated. And the Minnesota Science Fiction Society published the first 23 issues over a bunch of years, and then some colleagues and I, when MidSip was having financial difficulties, some colleagues and I negotiated our independence and brought out seven more issues, and then ran into some financial difficulties. So recently we have partnered with us in Minnesota, the sponsors of Diversicon. We're hoping we'll be bringing out an issue soon. But there was more to your question than that, I think.
Well, I was thinking in terms of, because you've been going this self-publishing route, I mean, in some ways, okay, yes, you had a organization behind you and you were working with other people to do it, but really you guys have been doing the marketing, you guys have been doing the editing, you guys have been doing all sorts of things. I think that you could share some stuff about that experience.
Well, I went into it sort of with the teaching function in mind, is an editor who gives personal feedback, I guess, as some of the notable ones in the field, such as John David Campbell did in the past. So I respond personally in all submissions. If it's all, in some cases, it's simply, sorry, this doesn't work for us, but you know, a handwritten note card saying that.
Yeah, and in some cases, it's 5 pages, single-spaced, handwritten.
Yeah. With comments of several people. Yeah. And that seems to work, because we've got the volume of pretty good stuff is really quite high. Another thing is I just have reading windows, like usually a month somewhere during the course of a year, accept submission so as not to get flooded with an impossible number of things. But the percentage of things, of stories that are pretty good is quite high. And partly because we're not very well known. I stopped publishing market reports a few years back when I realized that if we just put it up on our website, other people are going to find out about it and post it. So we get enough information out there, but it's still, you have to know something about the field to know that we exist. And because we respond personally on submissions, some people realize that we're just not the right market for them, and they stop sending stuff, and some people listen to us and they get better. So
I get the impression that you're not ready to quit your day job and support yourself from your editing.
Not this month.
Not this month.
I mean, yeah, I mean, if somebody called me up and offered a job with health insurance to edit a prosy, go for it.
I'm going to be having another meetup to go to, so I actually have to go off into the distance. Do you guys want to continue? Basically, I think we've got about 10 minutes to close up or whatever. You guys want to keep going and talking about stuff and coming up with ideas? I think the discussion's been really good, but there's been very little deathmatch. So, what's the score so far?
Well, I've divided out the different subtopics of what the publisher kind of does for you. And for instance, I wrote down speed. Self-publishing obviously wins if you're in a hurry to get your book out. Self-publish. Marketing was a tie. Whether you're going to have your book traditionally published or not, you're going to have to market your work. Distribution sounds like traditional publishing wins because they have the channels, they have the libraries, they have the institutes, these other distribution routes that you probably will never get. Editing quality, I think, you know, publishing wins, but I think that's only because publishing work has their own editing departments and they edit all their stuff, but traditional editors don't necessarily do that. So I think that that's only be that that's going to be your choice whether publishing them or whether you tie them to pay someone to do your edit your work. Control of self-publishing, and something that we didn't bring up was control over like your even things like your book cover or your title of your book. I don't know if everybody knows this, but if you're a traditionally published, you may not necessarily have control over the title of your own book or the cover of your own book. So self-publishing, if you're a control freak, if you're not, like you were saying about the person who was freaking out about the changes to their work, self-publishing is probably better for control freaks. What else? That's the score so far.
If you care about awards or CIFWA membership, traditional is the way to go.
Right. Some places like the Horror Authors Guild, I think, won't take, or Horror Writers Association, I don't think will accept self-published works. But no matter what your sales are, you sell, you know, unless Amanda Hawking gets a traditional contract, she ain't getting into that.
Well, now she's got the traditional contract. Right. She's good.
So, and added the points up, but I don't know. You knew the answer was going to be it depends on your business model on what works for you.
And book reviews, certainly attention. I think you get a lot more attention with traditional. Yes, sir.
Just do a quick plug after the meeting if anybody's interested. I'm involved with Diversicon, which is a small writer-friendly convention, which is coming up August 3rd to the 5th. And I have a small number of flyers here, but there's a FedEx Kinko's down the block, so if more people are interested, then I have flyers we can make more.
All right.
If it's time for quick plugs, I have a couple. I read Slush for Stupefying Stories, and I have cards here. Bruce Bethke is the editor, and he's always in search of fresh blood for his Slush readers because there's a certain amount of turnover. So if you're interested in doing that, it's very educational. Please stop by and pick up a card. Also,
Dracula. Dracula.
Yes. Also, I'm in search of someone who would like to create a website about their writing or other creative endeavors to read a guide that I've written for how to do that. And tell me if it reads easy, especially if you're not basically a technical person, because that's the intended audience.
Is this the one on the HERC?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I have a paper copy here, which I will hand over to whoever comes and tells me if they're interested in looking at it and giving comments. That would be great. And that's all that I have.
And I have the ever-popular bookmarks for my book, so please take one.
And what is your book called?
It's called Z is for Xenophobe.
Which you started out in the self-publishing route, and then found a publisher for it.
In a nutshell, I went against all of the advice I'd been told. Self-published it, sold some, didn't make very much on it. I actually took one of my... I mean, I literally made this thing in my basement and bound it and everything, and took it to a reading, handed it off to a publisher. He looked at it and said, well, we'll publish this for you. And so we went from being self-published to published by a publisher. And that's a very uncommon, weird sort of thing to happen.
Yes.
But of course, this was Sam Scott, and you guys had met under other circumstances, had already been introduced by, I think, Michael Merriman and Dana Baird and stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, they'd already been introduced, but he said, oh, yeah, this is what I do. And he was just handed it, not expecting... You know,
I fully expected.
I don't think you did.
And where does it stand with the sequel, Wise for Wiseman?
That's finished, and it's in the process of being finished.
There's something in between hope and expectation.
Well, I wouldn't hand it to him if I didn't expect.
I think you wanted to him to enjoy the book.
I did.
You didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition.
No one expects this Spanish.
You've been listening to the Minnesota Speculative Fiction Writers Group Podcast. The MinSpec Podcast is produced by Arbistaff and Weeby, recorded and engineered by myself, Conrad Zero. If you read stuff, you should join us on the web at meetup.com/MNSPEC. I just need my inhaler.